Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome to this special format of The Realignment. Sagar, where are we? Why are we here right now?
Shout out to WTF Media and Alex from Andrew Schultz's podcast. So we needed a place to do the live Breaking Point show, and so I hit Alex up. Turns out he has this awesome setup here in downtown Manhattan, which, by the way, they're not charging nearly enough money. So if you're out there and you need to film, hit these guys up. They do a really good job.
Yeah, so this is part of our Supercast launch week. Like Sagar said, we just recorded a great Thursday live show. We're going to put this in a slightly nicely better produced, better background. Just looking at our Zoom backgrounds. We know you guys have gotten tired of looking at the books. Basically, the idea is as follows. We've launched the Supercast. Sagar, we'll talk about that for in a second. But this is part of us expanding the show's format. I did 30 days of episodes. And something that really struck out to me and I got lots of feedback on is people loved it when we did these back and forth episodes where we didn't just ask guests questions, but we give our own takes, but even when we disagreed a bit, because that was something that people didn't quite know and actually added a bit of nuance to that that really worked well. So the way this is going to work is we're going to keep doing interviews. I'm mostly going to do those. We're going to increase the cadence of those. We're also going to feature Sagar on the discussion back and forth ones. There are going to be guests like David Sacks where it's like, okay, David Sacks is on the podcast. We'll make it work even with difficult timing bits there, but that's the broad thing. But yeah, just what's the Supercast deal?
Yeah, no, it's awesome. It's cool to see. And I think that the main emphasis I would make for people out there is like, it costs money to do this stuff. You know, it costs a lot of money. And whenever you're doing that increased cadence in terms of the man hours, the booking, the editing, and all of that, like you guys just need to understand, like even with Zoom, yes, you can just hit record and post it, but it's going to sound terrible. And it's like, in order to make sure that people are getting the most out of the experience, this is just the only way that you want to do it. The reason why is the alternative is that you have to try and go pre-sell ads and do all this other stuff. This puts you in a position of strength so that you have direct listener-supported audio. And then from there, you can say, okay, well, I have to fill in my X budget cap. If necessary, we can go out and go to market or whatever.
Yeah, and just the last bit that I'll add here is that I woke up one day and was like, hey, I want to do 30 days of Ukraine episodes. And that was a good instinct because we literally doubled our listenership during that period. But it's so hard to do that when you're powered by ads, where you have inventory and their expectations. Here's the thing. Would I have done that Ukraine pivot gamble if I'm like, oh, shoot, but like if this doesn't do well, I'm going to lose an advertiser. So the subscription business model, which like we really started with Breaking Points and are doing here, is really key to that. And then the last bit is like I want to limit how much paywalled content we have. Because the number one thing that happened when I actually said, hey, like we're going to launch a Supercast, give me feedback, a bunch of college kids wrote in saying, hey, I don't have extra money for this show. So can you please do as much as possible? So if you can support the show, you're actually helping people who are younger, who like, honestly, like I'm not going to expect them to subscribe to Breaking Points and the New York Times and to Glenn Greenwald, all these different things. So that's a really key bit here. So let's actually get into the news back and forth bit here. Jack Dorsey, Twitter, obvious. So Sagar, give a quick summation. We're recording this on Thursday, so everything could have changed. Just the quickest version of what happened.
Yeah, okay. It's let me set everything up. It is 2:08 on Thursday, April 14th. Elon Musk is currently speaking live. Now, what exactly is happening here? What exactly is going on with his offer in order to buy Twitter at $54 per share for $41 billion? Whether that's accepted at the point that this airs, I have no idea. That being said, and that out of the way, here's what's still important. What's important is that this has opened up all sorts of questions as to what does this mean? Is Twitter actually a good business? Why is Elon able to do this? What does he actually want to do? So I would point to his letter to the SEC, or he filed with the SEC in his tender offer to Twitter and the board of directors, who are debating it actively as we speak, and they have a scheduled town hall with their employees later today. We still don't know exactly what that means. He says, I believe free speech is vital to a functioning democracy. He doesn't mention anything about business. So at the time of this airing, he's still being interviewed on live. However, he was asked there specifically, and he said, I don't care about the economics at all. He literally said that out loud at the TED conference where he was being interviewed. So why does that matter? It means that he's spending this money specifically in order to exercise his vision of editorial control over what he sees.
Or lack thereof,
of a vision of how speech should function in American democracy. And that's just a really interesting framework. We haven't seen that happen in American business for a long time. I was thinking about hostile takeovers. I can't even remember the last time that a company this important this big in the public discourse had a hostile takeover, even for business reasons.
What's an example? You were talking about the 80s in our group chat this morning.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of the 80s, but these are companies like we wouldn't even really remember today.
Gulf and Western.
Right, exactly. It's like the airlines.
That from like Paramount ads right, and movies.
The airlines or more what I think of are a lot of the arbitrage guys who would get in on the deal. Ivan Boesky and these guys who eventually got convicted of insider trading. But
Wall Street. This is Wall Street. This was the movie Wall Street.
Exactly. It's literally so Wall Street, the movie, is based on the guys I'm talking about from Den of Thieves, and like what they were guilty of is getting the inside track on these types of deals, hearing what was going to happen, and then shorting the stock commiserately or buying the stock before it gets bought, etc., given their access to inside information. But that was about money. This is not about money. And so that's why I think this is so interesting. This is about how should we have speech online, especially on Twitter. Wow, like that's not an economic problem that you can solve. It's not a business question. And actually, that's why Elon's want in order to take the company private actually makes the most amount of sense, because it's not going to be beholden whatsoever to shareholders or any of that. The open question is, does he have the money? He said, I could probably get access to it. That's what he said. So I hope that's the case.
Probably he's
doing a lot of work there. I don't know if it's going
to
work.
Yeah, but what I'll just add to this, and I talked about this on the live show, I want to flesh it out a bit because I think it's actually a useful way to think about this. People should think of this as a rich person buying a newspaper. I know lefty parts of the audience aren't going to like this, but there's a long tradition in America and actually across the world. This is a thing in the United Kingdom. This is a thing in Europe, even in more democratically socialist, more social democracy countries, where the newspaper business, even at the height of everything, wasn't the greatest business.
Right.
If your family bought a newspaper or a magazine like the Atlantic Monthly, you did that not because you thought I'm going to have this profit-generating asset. You did it because you're like, hey, I believe in the Atlantic Monthly. I believe in National Review. I believe in these types of publications. So what Elon is doing, and it's interesting, he talks about like, you know, democracy and what this means. What did Jeff Bezos do when he bought the Washington Post? A few years later, they have a tagline, democracy dies in darkness. Now, you could think that's cringe. You could not like the Washington Post reporting. Sagar unsurprisingly thinks it's cringe. But the overall point here is that is what Elon is doing.
Yeah.
Elon is saying, actually, democracy dies under what he would call censorship. Democracy dies under bad faith content moderation gone wrong. So the question I'll ask for you then is, as we're then establishing under our thesis, this isn't a question about like the edit button, because once again, that isn't what makes Twitter not the greatest business. This isn't a question about a subscription feature. The question for you is, what should Twitter specifically look like under your opinion? Because people get to have opinions what this should look like.
Do you mean it from a content perspective or a business perspective?
Yeah, good. So
yeah,
let's operate under Elon's terms.
Yeah.
He's focused on the content moderation. We're not debating whether or not the business. So actually, I'll give quick context. So last year, Elliott Management, Paul Singer, those groups actually started buying up stock and basically effectively forced Jack out of the company, instituted all these changes because they didn't like the way it was being run. That was a business version of this. Elon's not doing a business version.
Right.
So give us the content version.
Yeah, I think the problem with Twitter, look, by the way, and this is also what's annoying about this, this is all a question of edge cases. For 99% of percent of people, it's not a problem.
But you're telling me my girlfriend's aunt who thinks with her 300 followers, she's getting like, censored.
You're probably not getting shadow banned. Your tweets probably just suck. That being said,
sorry.
It's an issue when the Babylon Bee gets taken down and then they get taken some ridiculous standards. It's an issue. I just saw recently the Russians with Attitude podcast was taken down supposedly for misinformation. Libs of TikTok gets locked for quote-unquote hateful content. And then the most egregious ones is the president of the United States and then the Hunter Biden laptop story. But that's the edge of the edge. But on a day-to-day basis, I just named three things that all happened in the last month. And it's very clear that it's going in a certain direction. So do I think—
Wait, what do you mean by a certain direction?
As in those are all right-leaning accounts, at least in the culture war type sense, or at the very least dissonant to the current cultural milieu. I think that's probably the best way
nice wording.
In order to put it. All of those things which are dissonant to the cultural milieu, those all get censored or they get locked or things don't go in their direction. All of the things which are supportive of the cultural milieu, those are not going to get locked. The Russians with Attitude one is a good example. I don't know what these guys were putting out there. It was possible they're putting out fake information about the Ukraine war. That being said, there's a lot of fake information about the Ukraine war that's also come from the Ukrainian side. By the way, I don't think that should be censored either. I'm not saying Ghost of Kiev or whatever should have been censored. What I'm saying, though, is that within the bounds of these are all people in America who are trying to push narratives and other things. I think it should be a relatively level playing field. Do I think state actors should have the ability in order to push something? No, absolutely not. And that's actually, I'm pretty sure that's illegal already, so it doesn't really matter. But what I'm pointing to is that there needs to be a proper enforcement. And at the very least, let's say that the policy was that the Russians with attitudes guys should get taken down. Then you have to see the same commiserate level of crackdown in the other direction. And you just don't see that. So I would say they have to go in one direction or the other. They can be actually enforce their rules on everyone in the current itemization. I'm actually against that for a variety of reasons. I don't think it's good for discourse. I think it's bad for the spread of information. Recognizing that elite discourse is on Twitter for whichever sector of society that you happen to be quote unquote elite in. And I think that's fine. I don't think there's an issue with that. You know, but I would err much more on the side of letting a lot more of the information be out there. Even with that, I also am very against these little context buttons and all that stuff outside of state actors, you know, this misinformation, unless it's connected to Chinese state media, Russian state media, Iranian state media.
You actually explain, you just set up a distinction. What is the distinction you just made?
Well, the distinction I made was that if it's a private citizen who's expressing opinion, even if it's fucking stupid and it's wrong, that doesn't mean that it needs to have a misinformation tag. If it's Donald Trump saying the election was stolen or whatever, okay, fine. He's a state official, right? Like U.S. government, Russian government, Chinese government, as long as you put tags on all Iranian government, or whatever, even British government, whomever. If you put tags on those things, I'm completely fine with it. I think private citizens should not have their material editorialized within some, quote, fake context, because it just opens up the door to more and more of, okay, well, then if you violate that, that means you could get taken down. So more what I'm saying is I'm going to err on being much less censorious than we are now, and that censorious, that's
censoriousness,
whatever, that censory regime should only be applied in the relatively rarest of circumstances.
Yeah, the thing that's hard for me here is, and actually Antonio Garcia Martinez, friend of all of our various podcast media enterprises, has a great thing. He was just on Rogan. It's called, his Substack is called The Pull Request. He had a great tweet where he said, "Don't pretend the issue is uncensored dick pics," to quote his tweet. That has existed.
So true.
That has existed. That has been banned forever on Twitter, on Facebook, etc.
Well, actually, wait, isn't porn on Twitter? I'm pretty sure it is. I think it's the only place it's allowed.
It's actually a good point.
Hilarious.
But his point is he did a good job of like delineating between.
Right.
Let's say Twitter did ban dick pics.
Yeah.
You would not have the cultural conflagration that you're having now. And he just did a really great, and for example, he's like, there's no actual cultural fight about violence on Twitter and Facebook. Facebook screwed up with the Rohingya, with the genocide in the country in 2016. I believe this was
Burma. Yeah.
It's the fact that we say Burma and not Myanmar is a very it's a hardcore tell.
I've been to Burma, so I get a pass. All right.
But basically, people were pissed at Twitter, at Facebook, for not correcting for that beforehand. But we did not have a societal fight over stopping that violence. So I think it's just very important that we focus on what's actually there. So we'll move on to the next topic. But the thing I just want to throw to listeners here is that now that Elon is setting these things in these terms, in terms of like, this isn't a debate about whether or not verified Twitter blue checks should be paid or not. That's a proposal. That isn't the actual debate. The debate is, what should Twitter look like? What should the spaces look like? And we all have to and can come to our own conclusion, because like, once again, seems like a lot of employees at Twitter are not gonna like Elon's vision of that. I'm not gonna dunk on them. Like, they can, once again, like, you shouldn't have to work at, like, if this is a newspaper,
yeah, look,
like,
leave.
You shouldn't work at CNN. Like, you have a different vision of how that is. And I think, I guess what I'm really realizing is what a lot of these Twitter employees are gonna have to reckon with is they no longer work at what we call a traditional tech company.
Yeah.
They now work at a newspaper. And I think it'd be normal to say, hey, like, there's a Rupert Murdoch, no one who works for the Wall Street Journal or Fox News, New York Post is like, Rupert Murdoch owns this? That's crazy. You know. So, you know, if you're at Twitter right now and you're not happy with this, and I guess this is so depressing, even in private business, you are probably going to have to start going to more ideologically aligned businesses, which is kind of a bummer.
Yeah, well, yes and no. I mean, here's the thing. Like, if it's a private company and if he doesn't care about the economics, then you don't need as much of the sales staff. You don't need as much of the moderation staff. And I'm of the general opinion that a lot of the jobs at these companies, not the engineering jobs, are, like, entirely fake. So a lot of these initiatives on, moderation and the trust and safety team, I just think most – and all those people are going to quit. Let's be clear. Like, if anybody leaves, it's probably them. I bet the engineers love him. And then the limited amount who don't, like, okay, you know, it's relatively replacement level scale. I'm not denigrating it, but there's a lot of very talented engineers. Last time I checked in Silicon Valley, I'm assuming they're probably going to have enough people, especially if you can staff Tesla and SpaceX, that are enough people who are ideologically ish aligned with what he's doing in order to go and get a job there. So I just look at it like with the employees, where I think there will probably be an exodus, but I'm just very skeptical that that will make a big impact on the product. And actually, this is, again, an indictment of Twitter. I just think Twitter is a shitty business. You know, I was reading about this, that Twitter actually has been internally described as needing to go private several times.
Really?
Yeah, by current board members under the current regime. Why? Because they're like, look, this company, it currently, they made, what, $5 billion, right? They're only getting a 5% profit. Guess what? They made $5 billion. Facebook made $500 billion. Yeah. Google made $800 billion or whatever in a single year, and their profit margins are also way higher. Why? Because they have a shit ton more daily active users, and they're selling ads at an actual scale. Now, you look at the Twitter business and you're like, okay, how many more people are there really left to onboard to this thing? Do we really need to be pushing ads and all this? Twitter Blue, sorry, it's not going to happen.
Did you pay for it?
No, I didn't pay for it. I'm not going to. So I look at Twitter and I'm like, I think it's at its end state. I think it just is what it is. I think it'll probably onboard.
Business.
Yeah, it's a nice business. $5 billion, right? But that's not even like a fucking hotel company.
It's not big tech. Big tech in terms of its importance, right, not in its actual business scale.
That's always the problem with Twitter. It punches very much above its weight because it's elite. That's actually why a newspaper makes a lot of sense. Guess what? Most people don't read the fucking news ever.
Yeah.
Ever.
But
that's
it's
fine.
Not about that.
Yeah, it's not about that. It impacts the discourse and the presidency and whatever, so you can punch well above your weight. This is why William Randolph Hearst and all these people own newspapers in the first place, in order to push the vision of the country in the direction that they wanted to. All of that, you know, said, like, they don't need to be companies which are trying to grow 10, 15, 20 every single year in terms of their percentage. It's like, no.
Yeah.
It's fine. The Twitter of 2015, is it really that different than today? No. You know why? Because the core value add of all the elites are on
don't
Twitter.
Don't besmirch Twitter Spaces.
Yeah.
Which is a good product. But
sure.
But that actually makes part of the problem,
yeah,
which is they actually, since Jack left, no offense, Jack, we like you, Jack.
Yeah, I like
they
Jack.
Turned on the product thing. They shipped Twitter Spaces and basically killed Clubhouse just like that. Like, that is not old Twitter.
Right.
In the defense of that. Like, they did all these. They bought Review, which is a good newsletter company. None of it mattered. Right? Like that's the crazy part.
Yeah.
So I want to get to the next topic. We're going to do Ukraine, which we obviously have to do. Let's start with something we agree on, then we'll get to something we disagree on. So we talked about this in a different setting. I'm doing this show at the recap. We were talking about President Biden's labeling of the events of genocide. And I want to make really clear what my actual position is, because people, as I'm talking more in these discussion formats, just providing this bit of nuance, I identify as a moderate interventionist in Ukraine. So I, and we'll get into this, want to see Sweden and Finland in NATO. I think we should be giving as much weapons as possible to the Ukrainian people. That said, those weapons for me do not include MiG-29s. I don't want NATO boots on the ground. I also don't want any no-fly zones. That debate was thoroughly won by the side that we're basically on here. So all that said, as a moderate interventionist, it may surprise people to say that when Biden said the genocide thing and doubled down, I'm just, my hand is in my face.
Well, okay. Well, how do you reconcile the NATO thing and that then?
Well, it's very easy.
No, because they're both incredibly on the side of, like, maximalization, politics.
Like, once again, like, Putin has never had any right to actually. Oh, this is actually good. I'm glad you pushed that. Here's the difference. I actively think that Sweden and Finland joining NATO given frankly Russia's history towards NATO, actually decreases the chances of actual conflict.
Yeah, I disagree with that completely.
Well, right, here's the point. Like, it actually decreases the chance of conflict. The only countries that Putin actually invades are non-NATO countries. Ukraine, Georgia, his military has been absolutely besmirched the past 2 weeks. Like, there's with them and NATO, you give your position. My position is NATO expansion. And once again, I do not support NATO expansion into Ukraine. I think that is a clear red line that Sweden and Finland are just not. They're already EU members.
So that doesn't make any difference. They've both been invaded by Russia in the past. Yeah, okay,
before there was the EU, before there was the EU, before there was NATO. Like that's that's the point. Like the reason why I'm like an internationalist, moderate interventionist is that actually like these international systems and structures actually make Europe more peaceful. Like you know your history. Like we get into this,
sure.
But like the first time that Europe has been at peace in over 1,000 years has been like the U.S. placing bases there, the U.S. offering a security guarantee, having those places. Your point that Finland and Sweden went to war with Russia, I think actually kind of supports my point in that the world that Russia was invading the Baltics, the world where the Nazis were going eastward, the world where Napoleon, and this is what Putin talks about, where Napoleon crashes across Europe in the Middle East and tries to take Moscow, is a world where there is no NATO. So that's my point. Just to finish the quick answer to your very good question, the genocide thing escalates, doesn't make anyone safer. Like, we could disagree on the NATO thing, but do you understand the distinction? I think NATO makes us safer. The genocide thing also calls, I do not think that makes anyone safer, and I also think it calls into question serious parts of our policy. So, for example, holy shit, as people who are born post-Cold War, the number one thing we've been told, and I believe this is this like never again idea, right?
So, especially post-Rwanda.
Right, post-Rwanda, right? So wait a second. If never again is something that we conceptually believe in, I think most people believe in this, why aren't we sending them MiGs?
Then we should be bombing them.
Wait a second. Right. Like, holy shit.
MiGs?
Like,
no, MiGs are like the...
Bare minimum. It's like, whoa, wait a second. Like, they're doing a genocide?
Yeah.
Why are we not like doing this, or that? So like, that is what I more mean, which is that like, it's at Biden's position. And this is like, which is my critique, right? Like, I'm pro Biden on Ukraine. I'm anti the way he articulates the things because everything he said, his policy, if you look at his actual decisions, makes sense. Mm-hmm. No MiGs because it would have been German US bases that transfer them. No NATO troops because that could cause a nuclear escalation. But a nuclear escalation is a red line on our side. He's been at a policy level, right? Like, I'm sure the policy papers are great. The way he articulates this makes no, like, that is my frustration. So yeah, let's hear whatever you want to.
Oh, the genocide thing is just,
this is why I said we're starting what we agree
on. Genocide just drives me insane because it's like, okay, well then we should go to war now. I mean, that never again is a real idea. People believe that. People legitimately have reconciled their fact that 400,000 Americans died in World War II in order to stop the Nazi genocide of Jews and against all-
Quick, I have to stop you so the commenters come after us. We obviously did not enter World War II.
Yes, I know, okay.
They're gonna come for
us. We turned away the ship and I fucking get it. Okay. Like, how do we recognize it in the year 2022? Do we think about it in terms of going to war just because we were bombed at Pearl Harbor? Like, no, we're described an ethos to ourselves of, look, it was a horrific price. Then the world went to peace. And also we saved millions of Jews potentially from complete and total cultural and ethnic eradication. And that was probably worth it. Easy to say, 2022, all that. When you say genocide, that's what you're saying again. You're like, Bill Clinton has even said this. I think we probably could have saved half of them. He said that verbatim whenever it came to Rwanda. So it's like—
Can you explain what's happening in Rwanda real quick?
Yeah. Oh, God, it's been a long time. Hutus, Tutsis, there's a long—
1994, there's an election. There's basically a president dies. This is a post-colonial African state that's not being instructed. This is peak—
Right, yeah. This is
either the British or the Germans or the French, Belgians.
I think it was the Belgians who elevated the Tutsis as like the small minority based upon their skin color in order to rule over the country. And then there was an election in which there was a dispute. And then a couple of politicians got killed and eventually cascaded into a brutal genocide. 800,000 people died. And there
it was horrible.
And there's actually a famous clip. I think it's of Susan Rice refusing to say the word genocide in 1994, where she's like, well, what's happening here is— And the reason why she wouldn't say it is because there are very specific actions that get enumerated under the Geneva Convention and under U.S. foreign policy that means that we should do something about it. And it's like, well, now—
Can I say one quick thing to add to the Susan Rice story? Because people like we do the history things. Interesting. So, but, and this is and by the way, this is how it's important to look at these case by case. Do you know what thing Quentin regretted basically not doing?
Yeah, that.
We could have, well, not just the genocide, we could have launched airstrikes against the government-led radio stations.
Right.
That were like, they were putting-
They were like, get your machetes out.
They were literally saying, get your machetes out and kill people. And I'm saying, like, we could have done that. I think we should have, like that's, it's nuanced, but we actually, without US troops on the ground, could have said, this is a crime against humanity. We're going to take out the government-run radio stations. That's what Quentin regrets.
Right. But, sorry, well, but they don't have nuclear weapons, okay? So, like, there's, well, that's the, point, there's the response. Yeah. So that's my general problem with the genocide rhetoric, with the regime change rhetoric. It's like, is there any off-ramp here ever? Like, no, there's not. Until Putin dies, he's a pariah state now. We're going to live in this current reality, which I think makes us less safe. Sweden and Finland and NATO. Look, it's a basic fact. Sweden and Finland both been invaded by Russia in the past. They've traded borders for the last 500 years. They're absolutely within the traditional Russian sphere of influence. Let's say that they are going to join NATO. They've said it's by June. Okay, so if he invades them in fucking May, what do we do?
He's not going to invade them.
Well, he might.
But
how do you know that? You're willing to risk nuclear war based upon that?
I think we're already risking nuclear.
Yeah, I agree. So why don't we increase the? Why would we increase the risk even more so?
Once again,
do you agree that it's going to increase the risk of a nuclear exchange with between the United States and Russia?
No, actually, not at all.
Well, I think that's completely ludicrous because let's say that there's a 5% chance. That's way too high. Based upon restoring the integrity of the Finnish border, I'm sorry. I don't care enough about the Finnish border. And look, I like Finland. I've been to Helsinki. It's a beautiful place. They have a distinct culture. Food is terrible. Sorry, Finnish people. That being said, I don't care enough in order to risk the integrity of 400,000 Americans. Let's say it is on the same scale as World War II. No, I don't think it's worth going to war on that whatsoever. Same with Sweden. Sorry, Sweden. Great country. We have, you know, long cultural alignment.
They're EU member already.
I don't care. We don't belong to the EU.
But this is my point, though. Like, how is this actually? But this is my point, which is that, like,
okay, then France and the UK are welcome to go in to do that. Okay, I would still not support it, especially under the auspices of NATO. But if they care that much, if France, Germany, and the UK want to defend the territorial integrity of the European Union, they are welcome to do so. And if Sweden and Finland were invaded by Russia, I would support the similar level of weapons that we're transferring to Ukraine to both of those countries. I think that guaranteeing their territorial integrity is important up to a point. I do not think that that point means giving them Article 5 nuclear umbrella protection. And NATO expansion is very clear as having been a specific part of why we are where we are today. Putin is the main reason why Ukraine got invaded. No dispute whatsoever. A lot of this was predicted, though, since the early 1990s as to how this would create an environment through which such thing could happen. I want to reduce the risk of nuclear war. And also, I just think the idea that we would have to go to war again in order to solve these problems of the bickering old world is ridiculous. Sweden and Finland's territorial integrity has zero impact on the future of the United States, its GDP, and its trading relationship with the rest of the world, specifically Asia. So I'm just of the opinion, well, I already know a lot, so it doesn't really matter. Like, I know that hopefully you don't have to play this clip in 25 years as there was at least one guy saying it, like one of those people. I already know a lot, so I know that the fucking Senate will just rubber stamp this without any debate, but there should be a real debate. There wasn't a debate about the Baltics. There should have been a debate about the Baltics. People should have listened to George Kennan. Nobody listened, and I'm not saying John Mearsheimer's doing himself any favors right now by downplaying
what he's doing.
John Mearsheimer's a realist scholar, but right now he's been giving interviews where he's like trying to downplay Russian war crimes, and this is what always my message
explain
to the realists.
This. Like, why do that? Because we're arguing, I need to offer you a compliment. I appreciate, and sorry, we can have a good conversation. You have your take. You don't do this weird gray zone thing where they, you know, where they're like, we argue against NATO expansion, but also everything you see is happening is a U.S. imperialist lie. Like, what does that possibly accomplish?
I don't know. It doesn't accomplish anything. Look, a lot of these guys are just so black-pilled, they're unable to see, like, the, you know, ironically, the gray area. So, like,
he said it.
What I would say is that, look, I think, and this is why I think emotion is very much on the side of these people, but emotion is what gets people into wars and has for a long time. I mean, look, the territorial integrity of Sweden and Finland, I would support, and this is the other thing about gradations. You can support somebody without offering them nuclear protection. Why can't we just do that? Yeah, we support you. We're not going to offer you a nuclear umbrella. And if Putin was really going to invade, you know, even given the current circumstance and how much he's getting his ass kicked in Ukraine and given the backlash of the world, well, okay, then that's just going to happen. And like, I hate to say it, and Sweden, Finland, it's a roll of the dice in terms of where you get born and in terms of the power and all that you have. And it sounds really sad in order to say, but the world is not the place where the United States guarantee the territorial integrity of these places. So I would just, I look at this, I see it invites a gray area conflict, very much so. Invasion, possibly a coup, assassination, all kinds of gray zone type conflicts, which very much that we could then test real red lines. So, for example, let's say they assassinate or pull off a political coup in Sweden. What do we do? I mean, what do we do about that? Like, that's not something that's in the playbook.
The thing is,
and that's why we should reduce the number of countries to which we have to have make existential decisions on.
But this is where our disagreement fundamentally comes down to, which is the only countries that Putin does gray zone activities are non-NATO
for
countries.
Now, for now.
No, but forever.
Well, that's the, okay. He's only been in power for 25 years.
What I will say though is, look, you took a risk when before the invasion you said you didn't think it was going to happen.
Sure,
I'll take my risk. He's not going to invade Sweden.
Okay, but your risk risks nuclear war. My risk just makes me look like a fucking moron on the internet. Like, right?
But that's the
difference.
But here's the thing, like. Putin invaded and still threatened nuclear war. So, like, it's this.
But Ukraine's not in NATO. If he does in Sweden, that's an actual red line. Like, then we literally have to have a nuclear exchange. I don't want to do that.
Why would he? And that's, I see where you got in trouble on Ukraine as I'm saying these things. Why would he possibly invade Sweden?
Yeah, it's a great question. Look, I don't think. I mean, it's not rational in order to invade Ukraine either.
But well, like, it actually was.
No, really.
No, it actually. No. Wait. Under your argument, it actually was quite rational, because his argument, if we're taking him serious to some degree, was that Ukraine represents an existential security threat to Russia.
Well, wait, B, you know, they've said the same thing about Sweden and Finland. So if he's done it once, we should probably take it seriously.
As we all know, like, the Ukraine has a different relationship to Russia in Putin's eyes than Sweden and Finland do. Like, for example,
this also applies to the Baltics, which are in fucking NATO.
Well, no, but it's different. So let me give a quick example of this. So this is what's hard, right? Because, like, I'm sure this has been a frustration for you over the past month, like, we're pundits, right? So we're not policymakers. Like, the only thing that matters what we say is, like, whether we get dunked on or people send us some money or not. I think that what Putin is doing in Ukraine is culturally genocidal. Now, I don't think the U.S. government should be saying that, but when he says, like, under the articulation of what genocide represents, when he says Ukraine does not exist, when his, like, literal, like, intellectuals who, like, write and support his project say, like, we want to abolish the existence of this thing, it's all fake, the language, that is a genocidal project. The project of erasure is genocidal. So all my point is that reflects the fact that he thinks that it's not a real country. Finland, Sweden, the Baltics, those are real countries. He has a fundamentally different relationship with them.
Maybe. I mean, look, again, maybe. The risk of, if you're wrong, is a nuclear exchange. And that's just too high of a risk in order for me to go about that. And look, like I said, at the end of the day, if a traditional deterrence of being a non-NATO aligned country within the European Union isn't enough to stop the invasion, then it wasn't worth it in the first place. And if 100 million of our citizens died because Stockholm fell to the Russians, I think that's crazy. I just think that's completely crazy. It's worth it for London. It's worth it for Paris. It's just simply not worth it for Helsinki and for Sweden.
Wait, but as you,
and
as,
we
as,
made these calls 70 years ago.
But as you just acknowledged, and this is where I'll ask you a history question. I'm sad you couldn't make the JFK episode, because, like, we're both huge fans of Fred Logoval. If in a world where Putin moved beyond, like, an Eastern European country and invaded Finland and Sweden, even in May, Paris, London, they get entangled very quickly.
Okay.
So let them
take the lead.
But you said it's worth risking for them. Let me make the broader point I'm trying to make, right? So, like, we both like World War One, World War Two. A takeaway that I have from World War One and World War Two is that it's impossible, given the nature of just, like, the world, like, Western culture, trade, etc., to treat Europe as just a petri dish. So, like, we could say to ourselves, look, we're in the U.S., we're positioned between the Atlantic and the Pacific, we're trying to be interested in other places. Let the Europeans fight. We tried that twice. Both times we were pulled in. So my assumption, And this isn't a recommendation. So look, I would believe we should intervene in that case, but this is not, I'm not making a policy judgment here. I am saying my lesson from the 20th century is when European countries have a huge bloody war together, we are pulled in very quickly.
Yeah, but the circumstances in which we should get pulled in are important. For example, it was important that Britain enter World War I in order to defend the territorial integrity of Belgium and not because of the Entente Triple Alliance system, which made it so that there were major tripwires. It actually got buy-in from the civilian population of the UK. And remember, we live in a democracy, so it's going to be the similar circumstance. It was also important that we don't enter World War II until we get literally bombed in Pearl Harbor. The tripwire of NATO means we do go to war for the territorial integrity of Sweden. That's not worth it. Now, if the UK and France and them get embroiled into a war with Russia and Russia risks the territorial integrity of our longstanding cultural nations going back 250 years to which we owe the existence of our country, then yeah, that's worth risking the war for. The circumstances under which you get pulled in matter a lot. It was important that the UK get brought into World War I for a good moral reason that the population could get behind. Because actually what you're risking otherwise is that Sweden does get invaded. And then it actually comes down to a real conversation here in the US and say, no, we're not going to do it. Because now you put your actual in question whether they would go to war for London or for Paris. Those are ironclad. That's in the blood right now. That's not the case. I mean, that's also why I think the fact that North Macedonia is in NATO is crazy. Same with Montenegro. Nobody knows where the fuck Montenegro is. Like, the idea that those countries deserve the ability for the full martial power of the United States government and its economic system and its civilian population to live once again under a ration system and a de facto authoritarian state, that should be a rare circumstance. And that's why
peace in Europe for the first time.
It doesn't matter.
No, this
is where it just sounds trite. Like, look, peace in Europe to me means peace in Western Europe. And like, look, sorry, Eastern Europe, like, it's just true.
Why?
I mean, it's just, that's exactly like whenever we look at where the major conflagrations come, it's whenever those countries which we're traditionally, culturally, and politically aligned with, those are the ones that we get embroiled on behalf of. We don't.
World War One started in the Balkans.
Yeah. Okay. And we didn't go to war over Balkans. We went to war in 1918.
But this gets to my
circumstance. Why did we go to war? Well, first of all, the circumstances which we entered were suspect, kind of, in World War One. But. And the reason why we ultimately went to war in World War I was because the German Empire was firing upon our civilian ships in the Atlantic Ocean. That's a direct threat to the interests of the United States while it's trying to conduct its business on our side of the border, so to speak. Now, should the tripwire of that existed for the Balkans? No, I think it's crazy. Like, should we have gone to war over the Archduke Ferdinand? No. Do I understand why Austria-Hungary went to war and Serbia and Russia and the German Empire and to a certain extent the French? Because they didn't really have a choice. They got invaded by the Germans and all that. Yeah, I get that. That's completely makes sense. This is why I think the circumstances. So even if we do get pulled in, you should get pulled in for the right reason. That's not a good enough argument for why you should get automatically pulled in, because I truly believe it would be a massive political threat to the actual integrity of NATO, because I think there's a high chance that we wouldn't actually follow through on that.
To sum up our argument, because we've gone a bunch of places, my position is basically that Europe going to war is a disaster, and the fact that it no longer goes to war is an accomplishment of U.S. engagement post-World War II. A big mistake we made after World War I was retreating from the continent under the belief that we could be isolated from them. And secondly, just because I want to just sum up the positions for folks, because people are going to, I'm not quite sure how it's going to split, like, in the comments section, but my position is as follows. NATO countries create conditions for peace. You're right, and that's a good articulation, that we wouldn't want a world where a war starts in the Balkans, and therefore we have to tripwire intervene. My point is U.S. policy and NATO policy should be to set the conditions by which war does not actually occur. My take here is there's a reason why Putin has invaded Ukraine and Georgia. It's because they're non-NATO countries. I think, especially given how terribly his military has performed, there's a very, very low chance that he would actually go into a NATO country. And frankly, I just think a war where he invades Sweden and Finland is actually such a war and such a crazy world that we would have to get pulled into that war no matter what, either way.
I'd rather get pulled in kicking and screaming than have to go in on day one. That's my response.
But if you get pulled in kicking and screaming, the question is, how do you get pulled in? I guess this is that's a good way of distinguishing them, because my take is we should not have to be pulled in the first place by setting conditions so war doesn't occur.
Well, war is inevitable. It happens all the time, as we've learned.
Why is war inevitable?
Well, we lived through 70 years of like relative peace in the continent. You just said 1,000 years of which they fight. I think it's relatively inevitable.
Well, but they stopped fighting.
Yeah, for a tiny period sliver of time.
But it's not just like a tiny sliver. They stopped fighting because the U.S. placed a humongous commitment.
Sure.
Risking nuclear war, to your point.
Right.
But a quick thing. Placed U.S. troops there. Also built up institutions that enabled the settling of, like, for example, like, all people, by the way, people love when we make Alsace Lorraine references.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry, I can't remember your name on YouTube. This guy was like, yo, they said, Alsace? It's actually really, there's probably some weird World War I hobbyist,
sure,
who listens. But basically, so this is a shout out to you, homie. But the quick point here is they fought over Alsace Lorraine for like 500 years. They stopped, and it's never going to happen again. It is never going to happen again because the Europeans, under U.S. military protectorship, created the European Coal and Steel Community that became the European Union. Yes, like, there's the whole Brexit discussion. Easily in the 2010s, the EU went too far. But at a core level, the idea is, hey, like, let's build a new Europe. And that's been accomplished, and that's been built not because of inevitabilism. Because I think, if the U.S. had gone home after World War II, yeah, there would have been another war. Almost certainly.
Yeah, but we didn't do the similar in Eastern Europe, and nor should we. I don't think that we should.
I think that's the new Europe.
Why? What's the point? The Eastern Europe has a GDP the size of, like, Texas. These are not places where there are massive strategic... Actually, Texas probably has a bigger GDP than all of those countries put together in terms of our trading relationship, too. Nothing. Russia's interest in that place, way bigger in terms of its actual ambition, in terms of its trading relationship, cultural ties, all of this. I'm just sorry. Like, look, I mean this... Very clearly, I feel bad for them. I think that we should support them. That does not mean that we should risk going to war for them. If we did get pulled in, the circumstances under which I would protest up until the time that they actually crossed a true red line in terms of cultural and economic importance to the United States. And I don't think Eastern Europe has literally anything to do with that.
How do you determine, this is just a genuine interview question, how do you define, and this is actually kind of away from even the Ukraine-NATO debate, how do you define cultural importance? Like, for example, I think of Nokia, IKEA, right?
Sure.
So what's your definition? I'm just curious, like, why do we have cultural significance with let's say, Germany, Paris, Spain, and not Finland?
Well, Germany is a more recent addition. But Paris, we literally wouldn't be a country without Paris.
Why can't we add Finland and Sweden to that addition?
Because Sweden wasn't there in 1780 whatever at the Battle of Yorktown.
Germany wasn't a country until 1871.
Yeah, and we literally built it up from the ground after we had to conquer it and occupy it for 10 years. I don't really want to do that for Sweden or for Finland. I mean, and this is the point too with London. A, you know, we have deep, we're literally an Anglo country whenever it comes to them. Whenever it comes to the French, we wouldn't exist without them. We've gone to war on their behalf. We fought, we're literal blood brothers in two different world wars, and we liberated their country by blood, by our soldiers. We don't have the same level of commitment, and nor should we, in terms of our ties with the Eastern European countries. This is why, look, in terms, cultural importance does matter. Like, the Baltics are much more important to the Russians than it is to us. That's why I think it's crazy that they have a nuclear umbrella by the United States. Same with Poland. I like Poland. I've been to Poland. I feel really bad for them. I've been to the Warsaw Museum and all that. I don't think that Warsaw should have a nuclear umbrella from the U.S. either. Like, this is the point. When these countries have been invaded multiple times and fought over and scrapped over by those specific instances, this is exactly the circumstance in which you want to avoid having to actually go to bring the full force of U.S. military economic power in order to defend it. Now, maybe we have to get dragged in anyways once one of our actual red lines gets crossed. Fine. But I actually think that's better because there's much more democratic buy-in. There's an actual red line that has been crossed. And instead of this inevitabilist argument, I think the history of conflict is one that if you go in with the mixed population response as we did in World War One, then you get 30 years of isolationism. I mean, you deserve it. I mean, same with Iraq. You go in under dubious circumstances and you sell a lie. What happens? People who are my age don't trust a goddamn word that the government says. That's why I was wrong about Ukraine. And you know, I don't really regret that mindset. I honestly don't, because it came from a place of watching the U.S. military lie to me about Iraq and Afghanistan for 20 years. That's what the Afghan withdrawal taught me. I was like, I don't believe a fucking word that you people say, ever. I probably still will be skeptical for the rest of my life. That's the point, which is that when you go in under these types of circumstance, you're responsible then for the actual democratic pushback. We don't live in an autocracy. So that's why, look, I'm so vehemently against this, and watching it happen, just, it makes me sick. Like, I can see it all coming from a mile away.
How can, and this is interesting, do you think the issue is that Putin has just been so bad in Ukraine that it's made it harder for your side to make the argument?
I do. Tell me more. You know who I think the elites are acting like right now? I think they're acting like Hitler in 1940. Hitler, 1940, pre-Operation Barbarossa. He said, look at these people. They can't even beat the Finns. 100,000 of them? They're garbage. We can take Moscow in a day. We're not these, like Napoleon. We have mechanized warfare. Look at these backward Russians. They're such a joke. Blah, blah, blah. What happens? 700,000 Germans die on the Eastern Front. And the Soviets
That's launching an invasion.
Okay, but my point is that they underestimated Soviet power.
But once again, we're not under... Underestimating Russian power would mean us saying, wow, actually, yeah, let's stick with the metaphor. And this would require Putin's paranoid mentality to be accurate. If this were 1940 and were Hitler in this example, the West would say, well, actually, oh, this is good. For the Star Trek fans, I know you guys like my Star Trek ships, as we have. So mirror universe, there's mirror universe Joe Biden. He's got a pointy beard like Spock. Mirror universe Biden says, oh, wow, I want regime change. Russia's army is proven weak. We are going to invade now. Now is the point. The rotted husk of Russia is ripe for the taking. But we're not actually doing that.
No, we're risking confrontation with that nation. And a lot of this, as you just said, is, oh, look at how Putin is doing in Ukraine. Look, I'm not saying it's not a data point.
To be clear, it's look at how Putin's offensive capability
Sure,
looks.
But look, once again, offense becomes defense real quick if you act in the wrong direction, and then next thing you know, you get embroiled in a situation. Look, Cuban Missile Crisis. What happened? 1962. One of our guys gets shot down. It's luck that we did not go to war over that. And it was only because of the genius of Robert McNamara and of John F. Kennedy that all of us are alive right now. But I don't want to live in that situation.
But that's a case where we are intervening.
What do you mean?
In that case, we were saying we want
missiles out of Cuba. Yeah, and if we're in NATO, then we're going to... You think that we're not going to have a NATO overflight of the Swedish border then? What happens? One guy goes 10 feet over the wrong border and gets shot down. What's going to happen?
We already do overflights of Russia.
No, we actually don't do that.
Wait, the U.S. already has a border of Russia, like up in like the Alaska Strait. Like, I don't understand what you're saying.
What I'm saying is that in NATO, if Sweden, Finland, and them get embroiled in NATO, and then there's some cross-border conflict, do you really want that to possibly escalate to a nuclear confrontation? I don't, especially given the history of all those nations that are involved there. Same with the Baltics. This is the one nobody can answer. And look, I already know I'm going to get a ton of hate from the Swedes and from the Finns. I'm sorry. Like, if I was you, I would want to join NATO too. I would also be scared, but I'm not you. Like, we have to look out for our interests and our country.
But my argument is our interest is no war in Europe. It's not a coincidence that the most prosperous time in human history has occurred when Europe stopped fighting.
If Stockholm got invaded and we had to go to a full-blown war over that, I don't think it's worth it whatsoever. And I think it has major democratic legitimacy.
That's a different argument. What I am arguing is we have an interest in Europe being at peace.
Okay, yeah,
Do we have an interest? So, for example, you're saying like we shouldn't back Poland. I don't think if we didn't back Poland, Poland would develop nuclear weapons. I don't think we have an interest in that.
Again, all interests have to get balanced. Like, we don't have interests. We have an interest up until a certain point, and it has to get balanced in the nuclear age with nuclear exchange. That's the other thing. I think there's a lot of 20th century thinking that's happening here in terms of what exactly these things mean. It used to be that the cost was, the horrific cost of World War II was what, 56 million, I think, the highest count. That's in an hour. That possibly double, triple. In an actual exchange. They say North Korea's nukes could kill 23 million in a single day. That's the shittiest nuke on the planet. And it could wipe out, oh, what, half the city or half the population of California. Like, these are scales of which we have not adjusted to. I honestly feel like we're back in 1955 or 1957 when all of the nuclear taboos were not on the table. And it's all like Kissinger being like, maybe we should use tactical nukes in Vietnam, or whenever they were like, hey, Eisenhower, you should use a tactical nuke at Dien Bien Phu or at the Suez Canal in order to defend the French and the British. Like, it feels like that level of stuff is back on the table, especially when we talk about Sweden.
Wait, from who?
Pardon?
But once again, this is why I'm like...
No, if no-fly zone... Sweden and Finland and NATO, as you know, would be an absolute zero non-negotiator, even in, what, 1992? Like, it was completely off the table.
Here's my big question. Why do you think Putin would invade Sweden and Finland? Because, by the way, like, the thing...
No, I don't, actually. I don't think that he would. But I think that there's a 15 to 20% chance that he would, so that means I 80% no, and 20% is high enough for me to be like, no, it's not worth it.
Okay.
That's my answer.
Yeah, I mean, look, like, as listeners know, like, the purpose of the show is not for us to come to a perfect conclusion. We'll see where the audience divides. I want to finish with a happier note.
Yeah, where are we at?
A happy thing, because we're nearing time here. Sagars, you know, people like when we talk about what we're reading.
Uh-huh.
So let's pull open our Audibles.
Okay.
Someone wrote into this, Nick Perryman of
Nick Perryman. I haven't
Wisconsin,
seen that guy in a long time.
Missouri. Sorry I didn't answer your email. Bad at that, but I'm getting better. Nick was asking, hey, I actually like Audible better. You and I actually like Audible better.
Yes.
So he doesn't use the bookshop purchase section to like buy books that we support. The answer, dude, there's no answer. Just buy it on Audible. We're okay. Like, we actually, the honest answer is that we get credit as a podcast whenever you all buy our books. Like, publishers, to give you a bit of open the kimono, they track when folks actually like spike. So a publisher would know, like, wow, like the realignment, smaller podcast than this bigger show, but you guys move more books. So that's all we actually ask me. So Sagar, let's open up our thing and say a book that we are reading that folks should check out. Has to have nothing to do with politics, whatever you want, or it can, whatever you want people to say.
I actually re-downloaded a book I listened to a couple years ago, which was Ashley Vance's Elon Musk biography, given what was happening. I was listening to that this earlier.
What's the name?
It's literally called Elon Musk. Another book that I just bought is by Chuck Klosterman. It's called The 90s, and it's like a meditation and essay on the 90s and on Gen X. Another book that I was listening
I tried to book Chuck. It couldn't quite come together. So
really?
Great
book.
We'll work on that, yeah.
Great book. And the other book I have is Midnight in Chernobyl, which is very relevant given nuclear power discussion.
Yep. And by the way, there's a new book coming out on nuclear incidents. And
oh, yeah,
an episode
cool.
You're going to want to
join,
actually. So, and my book that I will shout out and actually means a lot is, it's called Happy at Any Cost, The Revolutionary Vision, Fatal Quest of Zappos CEO, Tony Hsu. So this is actually, you should actually listen to this.
Yeah, I should listen.
Because basically, like, as people know, like, this is the Zappos CEO founder who died during COVID. So it's really fascinating because the title's perfect because it's Happy at Any Cost. He's a man who is obsessed with, like, helping other people and helping them actually get happy to the detriment deeply of himself, to the point where he eventually dies in a Connecticut shed, as an almost billionaire,
like, with fire. It was very
drugs,
odd, yeah.
Fire, like, not really, not great. So it's a deeply sad book. It's basically if you're someone who is very into 2010s, like, whether it's like biohacking or self help, it's really a devastating read and listen about what that's like. And honestly, like, the impact, as is clear in the title, the impact of COVID loneliness was terrible on him. And he's also a person who was taken advantage of in his isolated state by a lot of, like, actual hangers
on sad.
And grifters. So it's only 9 hours. It's on my Audible. Really recommend it. And it's a really, it's once again, not a fun read. So this isn't a fun recommendation, but it's really worth reflecting on as we go into the summer. So that is our episode. Everyone, thank you so much for tuning in. And, like, once again, if you could support the show and help support additional content like this that fits all of our needs, we'd love for you to go to the Supercast link at the top and support all of our great work. Sagar, take us out.
There we go. Thanks, everybody. And we will see you all next time.